Good afternoon, good evening, and good morning, Power Hour Nation, wherever, whenever you're listening. I'm your honored host, of course, Daniel Brigman. You are listening to the Power Hour radio show. The website is thepowerhour.com, thepowerhour.com. Today's date, it is a special one. Some events are so big, all you need is the date. You know, think back, December 7th, 1941. That's a day which will live in infamy. 11/22/63, the day the music died. You know, a couple examples. There are moments which take our breath away. Literally, they stop us in our tracks. They rearrange our view of the world. Today marks the anniversary of one of those days. 9/11/2001. The 17th anniversary today, 2018. Through the lens of some time now, it's been a little while. What does that mean? What does that date mean to you today compared to then? Do the threads still weave through our lives? There is one thing for sure, that day changed America. In the initial hustle to react to it, react to that event, what exactly were we reacting to? A few years later, after 2001, 9/11, what took the Kennedy assassination absolutely decades to reach, we had achieved in just really a few years. That is what? Doubt in the official story. Doubt what we are seeing. On the altar of security, of course, wrapped in some star-spangled cocoon, the most precious parts of our nation were sacrificed. Our Declaration of Independence, our Bill of Rights, our Dominion, all these things. Our first guest today, she became a lamb to the slaughter, so to speak. Susan Lindauer was an intelligent asset who not only warned about 9/11 attack, but she used her influence then to warn about the danger and moral hazards of invading Iraq. Wanted to testify on the commission. A hero in so many senses of the word. What did she receive for her trouble, for her sacrifice, for her sticking her neck out? She got a jail cell and the prospect of indefinite drugging under the authority of the Patriot Act. Her story is horrifying and beautiful all at the same time. We are very honored to have her here today. Susan Lindauer, welcome to the Power Hour.
I am honored to be on with you, and I tell you, it did change our world, and I am so grateful there are so many people who are awake and vigilant now defending our Constitution, and we have taken back our patriotism, and we have got to keep going because there's for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction, and I'm convinced the universe and the force of God, which I do believe in, will not allow this story to die. Truth will prevail. It is always prevailing every day that we persist.
Now, you've written a book about, we're going to talk about your leading up, what happened and all. The book you've written, ladies and gentlemen, you can go get it where books are sold, Amazon, what have you. Extreme Prejudice, The Terrifying Story of the Patriot Act and the Cover-Ups of 9/11 and Iraq, Susan Lindauer. So that's the name of the book. Let's go backwards a little bit, give people a little segue, you know, up until your arrest. You were working as an intelligent asset on Iraqi, I think Libyan, Iraq, intelligence, anti-terrorism. Go ahead and start there, and then leading up into 9/11.
I first learned about the 9/11 attack from my CIA handler, Dr. Richard Fuse, in April of 2001. I had been a back channel to the Iraqi embassy and the Libyan embassy in New York at the United Nations since 1995, and I existed for the purpose of communicating messages back and forth involving terrorism. So I had done this before for many years at this point, for 6 years at this point, with the most hostile pariah nations at the time, on Earth at the time, Iraq and Libya. And I was told by my CIA handler, he called me up and he said, I have a message I need you to deliver to the Iraqi embassy. I need you to go immediately. I said, sure, that's my job. That's what I do. So I went over to his office and he said, we have intel, this is April of 2001. We have intelligence that there's going to be a terror attack involving airplane hijackings and or some kind of airplane bombings and some kind of attack on the World Trade Center. So we had bombs, airplane hijackings, and the World Trade Center. And he said, I want you to go to the Iraqi embassy and tell your diplomats that we are demanding Iraq must provide any intelligence that they've got on this. on this attack. If they fail to give it to us and we find out later that they possessed it, we will bomb them back to the Stone Age. So I said, okay, I did this all the time. Okay, I did this all the time. This is very important for you to understand. So this was not, you know, a big deal. This was in April of 2001. It was not a big deal.
Well, hold on, Susan.
Okay.
What do you mean it wasn't a big deal? Say it's not a big deal. I mean, it sounds like a big deal.
It was a big deal, but it was the kind of message that it was the kind of message I delivered all the time. So I said, okay, I'll go deliver the message. And then I went up to New York and I said, hey, Iraqi diplomats, we expect there's going to be a terrorist attack and we want you to tell us anything you know about it. And I came back to New York, back from New York, and the diplomat in New York said, we'll be happy to pass that message on to the Iraqi embassy. To Baghdad through our diplomatic cables, no problem. Well, if we hear of anything, we'll let you know. Iraq had been one of our best sources on terrorism intelligence going back for many years. Saddam Hussein feared the Islamic jihadists. He feared that they would try to destabilize his regime and take advantage of the deep poverty caused by sanctions. So he was always willing to help us. So the first time I delivered the message, I was pretty nonchalant about it. I said, hey, we heard about this. Find out anything, let me know. And he said, okay, sure, we do this all the time. We have this open door. Nobody was threatened. It was just, you know. So I went back to Washington. My CIA handler said, so what did the Iraq say when you threatened them? And I said, I'm being honest with you. I'm telling you what really happened now. This is the real story of 9/11 that you don't usually hear. So I said, I didn't threaten them. First of all, I said, I did not threaten them. I said, they help us all the time. They're going to get, he promised me he'll get the intelligence if there's anything to give us. He said, I did not tell you to be nice to those people. I want you to go back and I want you to deliver the message exactly as I have communicated it. This is a dangerous threat. And he used very strong language, which I cannot use on the radio, or the FCC would pull your license. So you'll have to take my word for it.
Not today, Susan.
It was pretty powerful language, and he stormed around his desk yelling at me, stormed around the conference table, yelling at me that I had misunderstood, that I must go back to New York immediately. So I went back to New York, and I said, hey, guys, I apparently did not deliver the message correctly. I've been ordered to tell you the following. This came from Dr. Richard Fuse. He said, I want you to tell the Iraqis the threat originates above the Secretary of State and above the Director of the CIA. We will bomb them back to the Stone Age if they do not give us every single thing they've got on this attack. And the diplomat looked at me, the Iraqi diplomat. Now, that is only three people. President George Bush, Vice President Dick Cheney, and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. There's only three people. And so I went back and
I said... Who do you think it came from?
All of the above. Absolutely all.
Okay.
And so for some people who say, well, you're not in, I was the CIA and defense intelligence asset. So all of the communications that I had were going through the Joint Chiefs. Okay. So it could be that they also knew. Okay. There's a possibility the Joint Chiefs, but the threat that the Joint Chiefs knew. However, the threat originated with those three people. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, Vice President Dick Cheney, and President George Bush. So I went back and I said to the Iraqis, guys, I messed up. I should have been much more forceful, and I have been chastised for it. I said, I want you to know they're going to bomb you back into the Stone Age. He said they're going to bomb you more ferociously than you've ever been bombed before, that they would consider this an act of war, and they will retaliate with war. And they said, and the diplomat said, oh, my goodness. He got really upset, and he said, wow. And here's the key. He said to me, Iraq has already agreed to allow the FBI to send a terrorism task force into Iraq, into Baghdad, for the purpose of conducting terrorist investigations, interviewing witnesses, and making terrorist arrests. This was offered after the bombing of the USS Cole in October of 2000. The Iraqis had deported a Saudi national who was threatening to overthrow the Saudi government using an attack in the port of Yemen, one of the ports in Yemen, as a base to launch sanctions and create friction. The goal was to create so much damage in between U.S.-Yemeni relations. They hoped the Yemeni government would be so impotent and incapable of responding that they would, that the Yemeni people would be hit with terrible sanctions. The Iraqis were furious over this. They were appalled. They were already suffering under sanctions. They didn't think anybody on earth should suffer what they were suffering. And so they came and told us about the attack. I then notified my CIA and defense intelligence handlers, who put the messages all the way through to the Joint Chiefs. Then I went back to New York and warned the Yemeni ambassador at a Friday night dinner 4 days before that attack occurred. Okay, the attack was actually Wednesday night, Thursday morning, D.C. time. So it was the USS Cole. I warned them about 4 days, the Yemeni ambassador, about 4 days before it happened. I was not able to give them more specifics, so they were not able to stop it. However, it is worth noting that the USS Cole gave shore duty to all of its people, and they stood down on basic security regulations that stop vessels from, smaller vessels that are just, they're standard operating procedures, that's standard security procedures that prevent vessels, smaller vessels from approaching them. So the USS Cole had also been a sort of false flag, let it happen, make it happen, because there was an agenda to get into Yemen. It was, the Iraqis had explained that the outside. Oh.
Welcome back to the Power Hour, thepowerhour.com. Ladies and gentlemen, this interview is extremely important. We'll make sure Catherine gets it up. We'll get it commercial free. It'll be up on the website. You can download it. Now, we got share buttons now. You can share this as when we break these interviews down. This is extremely important. The war of information, the war of convictions is starting to tip on certain things. This is one of them. The majority of Americans do not believe the official story of 9/11. Let's push that wall and break through, because this is a real opportunity for us, and Susan Lindauer is right at the heart of it. Susan, wanted to continue with the USS Cole, then I have a real important question, I think.
Okay, I just want to finish up with the USS Cole. It's a question of let it happen versus make it happen. The Joint Chiefs of the military knew the attack was coming several days beforehand. It was very easy for us to target which ships, which U.S. vessels were in the port of Aden at that moment. There were only one or two, and they were ordered to have ships leave and stand down their protocols, their security protocols. The reason was the United States wanted to get into Yemen because the Al-Qaeda forces that we now call Al-Qaeda wanted to use Yemen as a base of attacks on Saudi oil fields, which endangered U.S. Economic prospects. Okay, so jumping ahead back to 9/11. Okay, in April and May, when I first go to the Iraqis and deliver the message about the threats about 9/11, the Iraqis respond, "We have already authorized the FBI to send a task force into Iraq." The diplomat said, "Look, I'll send a cable to Baghdad. This is an emergency. You tell the FBI to come to me, and I will tell my staff to, I will process your visas with rapid speed. When the FBI comes in, I'll make sure that my diplomats here know that this is an emergency. They should interrupt any meeting that I'm holding anywhere, and I will immediately break off whatever I'm doing. I will come straight back to the embassy. I'll be here in 10 to 15 minutes maximum. I will stop everything to do this for you, because we want to show the United States our commitment to national, to the good neighborly security, not only for the United States, but for all the peoples. Iraq at this moment was in the process of negotiating the return of weapons inspectors, also through me and through other sources, and I was in contact with the Iraq's ambassador and senior diplomats and other members of the Security Council. Iraq wanted to get out from under sanctions. Terrorism, the 9/11 attack was a tragedy for them as well, and they would have done anything in the world to help us if they could. Over the summer, the problem was is that when I went back to Washington and I told my CIA handler, and defense intelligence handler, that the Iraqis would let the FBI come in, the Washington did nothing. Washington took no action, even though repeatedly I went back and said, I'm supposed to ask you again, what do you know? And the chatter throughout the summer of 9/11 became, in the intelligence community, became louder and louder and more vocal. There was more panic. More people were frightened and frightened. We're not frightened like regular people get frightened. When we get upset, we'll pound you into the dirt. you don't want to get me upset because I'm gonna beat you. I'm sorry. I'm not being nice. I'll be nice. But we don't get upset. We don't get frightened like regular. Our reactions are not like other people's reactions. If you threaten me, I'm gonna punch you. I'm gonna punch you back. So I'm going to pound you back. And so, it's like if you throw a punch at me, I'm going to meet you. I'm going to meet you with a fist. And that's what ends up happening.
Let me interject.
Sorry. Sorry.
No. Don't apologize. This is wonderful. Let me interject a couple questions. One, just to be clear, the Cole incident was when Clinton was president. Iraq, of course, 9/11 was when Bush. So there was nefarious things going on here in the Middle East, and it didn't matter who the president was.
Exactly.
Two, my question is about you personally. You said this is kind of commonplace, this back and forth. Did you start to get suspicious? Did this seem like a setup? What was going on in your mind when you were seeing this back and forth?
Our tension was growing. Over the summer, the chatter on this particular terrorism attack escalated rampantly, exponentially.
What does that mean? You were hearing on the line, people were saying.
Every conversation I was having with my CIA handler, Susan, the CIA keeps talking about this attack. Susan, you got to go back to the Iraqis and get intelligence on this. My next door neighbor.
Go ahead, your next door neighbor. Quick, 10 seconds. Go ahead.
My next door neighbor was moving in. I said, if you knew what was going on, you'd go back where you came from.
All right, Susan, we're moving up. Spring, early summer. There's chatter, kind of unusual requests
August,
going back, demands, and then August. Go ahead.
August was a big month in the fight to stop 9/11. People do not realize how much action was in play right at that moment. On August 2nd, Robert Mueller was sworn in as head of the FBI, as director of the FBI. And on that day...
The Robert Mueller
was sworn in, and on that day I had a prescient conversation with my CIA handler. I was not at my home. I was at a consulting job in downtown Silver Spring, Maryland. And when I came back from a trip to Japan, the first time I told this story, I found a copy of the Wall Street Journal tucked under a rose quartz paperweight that had never been there before, and it was from that location, dated July 30th, 2001. And this was 10 years later in October of 2010. Okay, so somebody heard my stuff in Japan, and they wanted to let me know that everything I'm saying to you right now is validated because other teams were in on this, too. Okay, so on that day, that was August 2nd. Let me tell you the story.
Go ahead.
Robert Mueller's confirmation hearing, I said to my CIA handler, there has never been a terrorist attack that man did not throw. I think he's a terrible choice to be head of the FBI when we are facing this monstrous attack that is coming. And my CIA handler said, Yes. What happens if there's no FBI director when the attack occurs? And I said, oh, my goodness. You mean you think it's that soon? You think it's going to be? He said, yes, the attack is imminent, Susan. We know that it's coming any day now. And I said, oh, my goodness. Well, except I use stronger language. I said, oh, my goodness, I will go right back up to New York and I will talk to my Iraqi diplomats one last time. This is August 2nd. On August, and he said, oh, Susan, don't do it. Do not go back to New York because until after this attack is over, because we're expecting mass casualties and we're expecting, you know, possible radiation dust. We're expecting, you know, pollution, you know, contamination, toxic contamination in the air from the dust that's going to come from off this attack. So he said, I don't want you going up there, even though I would not be in the World Trade Center at the point of the attack, because I wasn't going to be stupid. He thought I'd run down to, you know, to see, you know, go stand close to the buildings, and you could that in itself, being in proximity to this thing, could kill you. Okay, so that, like, the radiation levels and the dust will kill you. Okay, so he said, don't go up there. I order you not to go up there. I said, Richard, I have to one last time. I will go up on August 4th, which is Saturday. And I will go up and I will just ask the Iraqis one last time if they've heard anything about this attack. They keep telling us they don't know anything, but I'm not going to leave this undone. I got to go. And he said, okay. Then don't go back again. So I go back. I go up to the Iraqis. I say, okay, Iraq, any news, any fragment of intelligence? They say, no, all of the chatter comes back to you. Everything that's coming out, we're hearing about this attack. See, they're
meaning
Washington and the CIA. He said, we're, you know, everything that we hear is sourced back to you. Now, during this period, other intelligence agencies, Germany, Russia, all these other intelligence agencies were also picking up the chatter. But the problem was the United States was the source of the chatter. So nobody else had anything except America, except Washington. Okay, so that's a very important point. So I go up to, and the Iraqis throw up their hands, and I said, look, if this happens, you are at grave danger of getting bombed back to the Stone Age. They said, we know. We still don't have anything to tell you. So I went back, and I said, and this was on August 4th. I can tell you the dates because August 2nd was the date of the Robert Mueller nomination hearings in the Senate. And August 4th, 2 days later, is Saturday. And then August 6th is the same day that Richard Clark gave President Bush the presidential briefing memo at the Crawford Ranch in Texas. The presidential briefing memo detailed the CIA's warnings about 9/11. And apparently, George Bush said, and I quote, okay, you've covered your A, you've covered your A, now let's go play golf. Now let's go play golf. And so they did. But meanwhile, in Washington, we didn't know that, so we were trying to figure out how to get a message to Andrew Card, who is my cousin, chief of staff to George Bush. He is the guy who leaned down on 9/11 and whispered in the president's ear, in the school classroom, while George Bush was reading the book to the children about the goat. Okay? I don't know if the book was upside down. That's like a myth or not. That's like an urban legend. But what is not an urban legend is that I sat outside Andrew Card's house. Two things happened that week, immediately after that meeting on August 6th. One, I sat outside Andrew Card's house for 2 hours. Chain-smoking cigarettes. I have now stopped smoking, but on that day I smoked practically a whole pack of cigarettes, just sitting in that car waiting for Andrew Card to come back. And driving away, I felt I was making the greatest mistake of my entire life and that I would regret it till the day that I died. That's what I believed before 9/11. This was August 8th, August 9th. On August 7th or August 8th, before I go to Andrew Card's house, Richard Fuse told me that I had a phone number to the private office of Attorney General John Ashcroft that went straight into his office. And he, whoever was picking up the phone, I was told, could look across the room and see and lay physical eyes on John Ashcroft. So this was as close as you could get to the Attorney General without actually calling him and having him pick up his own phone. Okay, so this was his staffer who answers his phones and who could look and lay eyes, the key was to lay eyes on the Attorney General in a heartbeat. They could get a message to him. I had been ordered never to use this phone number except in an absolute emergency if there was an imminent terrorist attack and I could not reach my CIA handler or defense intelligence handler. In point of fact, from 1995 onwards, I never used this phone number except this one single time. And I called up, identified myself, and at this point I was not the crazy, incompetent, you know, asset. I was actually a very high-level asset who had Iraq and Libya, and you just didn't get those countries unless you were very, very good at what you did. Okay? So, you know, I didn't have these, like, I didn't just stumble into this. I was very good at what I did. Okay, so I called up and I said, look, we are speaking, we expect a major terrorist attack against the United States is imminent. We expect, we are seeking any fragment, we are asking for an emergency broadcast alert across all federal agencies. We expect a major terrorist attack to occur. We are looking for any fragment of intelligence involving airplane hijackings and or airplane bombings and a strike on the World Trade Center as a known target. That is an absolute known target. The methodology is a known methodology. The target is known. We think there might be the possible use of a miniature thermonuclear device, which was all through the summer of 2001, we always talked about the mini nuke. That was always in the original scenario of the attack, that there would be not a Hiroshima mushroom cloud kind of bomb, which we actually discussed. Will this create a mushroom cloud? But it would involve a miniature nuke. And I said, we want an emergency broadcast alert. The guy said, call this number at the Office of Counterterrorism, repeat this message, and we'll get this out immediately. John Ashcroft said, oh, that's the CIA. They keep talking about this attack. Ignore them.
Welcome back. We're talking to Susan Lindauer, of course, and her experiences before 9/11, intelligent asset right in the middle of this whole thing. Susan, why don't you continue? John Ashcroft, you got a message, and he said, oh, it's them silly CIA people. Forget about it.
Yeah, that's right. But the Office of Counterterrorism had also received our request for an emergency broadcast alert, and they took action. They did it, and Minneapolis FBI responded. I'm not sure how all the different agencies they put it out to, but they did put it out through the FBI. And the FBI in Minneapolis responded with news about Moussaoui, who is the, quote, 19th missing hijacker who was captured. They put in, now listen, they put in a request for a FISA warrant to open up his communications, his cell phone, his laptop that was all encrypted, and they put it through to John Ashcroft. John Ashcroft refused. So what you see here in 9/11 is very much what you would expect to see in the John F. Kennedy assassination. The protocols that would have immediately worked and achieved the results to stop the attack are pulled away. Now, I want to quickly jump to President Trump. This is so important. I want to tell you, President Trump is one of the good guys. From the first hours after the attack, President Trump, as citizen, gave a TV interview where he said he talked about the explosives that brought down the building. And he recognized immediately, intuitively, he saw the real picture, the real story of how this had happened. This is a magician's trick. Not, and I don't use that with those words casually. I'm not trying to insult anybody. It's a magician's trick. All eyes are on the left hand, but the real action, that's the airplanes flying into the towers. But there is no way in physical earth, in the laws of physics, that an airplane crashing into the building would result in a controlled demolition in 10 seconds of the entire World Trade Center towers. Not possible, people. It just isn't. No. The answer is no, no, no. Okay? Doesn't work. So there had to be demolition. There had to be explosives in the building. Now, on that, what I have been told by a State Department employee whose wife was in the NSA, and they were both afraid of losing their pension, so they could never go forward. They say that speaking about his wife, that there was, on about September 23rd, give or take a day, for about 10 nights in a row, strange vans with no markings were captured on the World Trade Center security footage.
You mean August 23rd?
August 23rd to September 3rd. Sorry. For about 10 days, sorry, August 23rd, give or take a day, for 10 nights, the security cameras at the parking garage of the World Trade Center captured these vans arriving at about 3 o'clock in the morning, leaving at about 5 o'clock in the morning. They arrived after the janitorial trucks had left. They had never been spotted in this building before. And after about 10 nights, they were never seen again. They were either bringing something in or taking something out. But nobody knows what it was. It could have been the miniature thermonuclear devices in the basement of the building. It could have been the final detonation devices that were necessary to trigger off the explosives. Or they could have been taking out the gold. They could have been, why waste the gold? Somebody could have stockpiled all the gold that was in the World Trade Center as well. So there's a couple of scenarios that have been proposed as to what they were doing there. But the fact is that they were not, that they were investigated. They are not the janitorial trucks. They have no markings and they've never been explained by the FBI. The FBI took the footage of the vans and removed it and it was never seen again.
All right, let me interject here and ask a very important question. From your experience, obviously, 17 years later, everything that's happened, the excuse, we remember what we felt like on that day. We remember what we were told. If you're not with us, you're against us. George Bush getting up there, all the concerts in New York, the whole thing, the whole propaganda machine to get us now to go kill brown people in the Middle East and what have you and whatever. From
yeah.
your experience, your knowledge, your expertise, I want you to answer this. Is there any way possible that attack, whatever you want to call it, occurred without the cooperation of intelligence assets in the United States?
Absolutely no way. This would have been, it would have required, some people say, allies in Israel. I've heard that new intelligence from a brand new witness, Robert Alexander, that Prince Bandar came to his store, Saudi Ambassador Prince Bandar came to his store in San Diego with one of the hijackers whom he recognized, and then after 9/11, he reported that to the FBI immediately, and John Brennan and James Clapper both showed up at his little store in San Diego, interviewed him, and he also claims that he was attacked and assaulted in a men's room in the Harrisburg, Pennsylvania airport, and that he was coming back from the Little League World Series. The Little League teams were having like a Little League World Series in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and he was there for that. And the guy who he'd seen at his store in San Diego suddenly comes into the men's room and with about 7 or 8 other Arabs, and they beat him up very badly. They tried to knife him. He had knife cuts on his body, and he went running out of the men's room. There was an Arab woman blocking the door, and he rushed over her and just, you know, getting out of the room, just kind of knocked her down. Whether she was there for any reason, he doesn't know. But he then tried to get it. He then went racing onto the airplane to get out and went through airport security to get out. But he told James Clapper and John Brennan both about this. And he says that they came back afterwards and said, yeah, we checked out the security footage at the airport. And you're right. They were there. They verified it. But he thinks that, but then he was threatened that he should shut up and never tell anyone, or he would be severely punished and could be, his life would be at risk, his family would be at risk. And, okay. And he only revealed this information after John Brennan lost his security clearance.
When the warning went out, you tried to get Ashcroft, a warning did go out to the intelligence agencies throughout America, wouldn't the World Trade Center be monitored heavily at that point?
If they actually cared about stopping the attack, it would have been very easy.
Yeah.
All they had to do was put an anti-aircraft battery on the top of the building and shoot down any plane as it was flying over the water. Easy.
Oh, my gosh. There's the break. We're going to extend this interview. Susan has been so gracious to spend more time with us. This is mega, mega, mega important. Ladies and gentlemen, we are breaking through the lies. This story is a major kick in the teeth of the deep state.